is United States v. Secord. Mr. Hockenberry, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Captain Dove, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well then, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Scott Hockenberry. Captain Amir Hamden is at counsel's table. Along with Mr. Dan Conway, we represent the appellant. Chief Judge Olson, could I reserve 5 minutes, please?
Granted.
The data at issue here was within the possession, control, and especially custody of military authorities, activating appellant's non-discretionary 701 alpha rights to inspect and copy it. There is no basis in the rules for the military judge's stipulation that appellant could only exercise his 701 alpha right if he agreed to give the government full access to his personal data, and the government has not disproved prejudice. When there are both general and specific rules on a given topic, the specific rule controls, and that's Justice Scalia's general specific canon. 701 Echo is a notably general rule. 701 Alpha and Bravo are very specific rules about the party's disclosure obligations.
So, in terms of, before we break it down into that, if I may, I'd like to ask you a very basic fundamental question. I think you've already touched on it a little bit, but I'd like to give you an opportunity to flesh it out more, and that is, how can it be said that the government has possession, custody, and control over evidence if the government doesn't have access to that evidence?
Right. Your Honor, the 701 triggers are not access. They are possession, custody, or control, which are disjunctive. We would contend all three are met, although this Court need only agree on one of the three to activate the 701 requirements. But we would contend that probably the strongest is custody, because custody means guardianship, and whether the government could access this data or not, it certainly had guardianship over it.
So along those lines, whenever we're dealing with issues now of data on a cell phone, it's always imprecise to use more traditional analogies and hypotheticals, but on page 3, I think it was, of your reply brief, you raised this issue of a locked safe. And if I may, I'd like to flesh that out a little bit in terms of a hypothetical and ask for your thoughts on how it would play out in the real world. Let's say that there is a portable, indestructible safe, and a witness says that the accused put the murder weapon in that safe. CID seizes it, brings it down to the CID office. CID can't get into it, but the accused has the combination. What happens in the real world from your perspective in terms of two things? What is CID supposed to do then when the accused comes knocking, looking for that? And how would this play out in a 701 motion before a military judge?
Right. Your Honor, I think the principle would be largely the same in terms of that would be seized from or belonging to the accused, so the accused would have the right to inspect it.
So when you say, that's why I want to kind of get down to the practical, real-world steps that would happen here. When you say that the accused would have the right to inspect it, what would happen in that CID office with that safe?
Right. Your Honor, I think the mechanics of opening it up and copying it would be quite different, because in the case of a cell phone, an exact copy can be made without changing anything quite easily, which obviously cannot be done with physical objects or physical papers. But the facts here would be that there was a great deal of information above and beyond whatever the government was looking for, also in, as the government calls it, the container. So maybe not just the gun, but all of appellant's personal papers. And the military judge would have required government access to all of it. But
So what if the military judge here had limited it? Let's get out of this case to make things a little bit clearer. Let's say that search authorization is simply for photos, because the allegation is child pornography. And the accused comes in and says, I want access to the photos. That's the first hypothetical. What would happen then?
Right. Your Honor, I think if the reciprocal access the judge had conditioned appellant's access on was limited to the basis of the search authorization, that certainly would have been much more logical. I'm not prepared to concede that that would have been proper, but that's not the facts here. The judge would have given the government everything, which would go above and beyond, well above and beyond what the search authorization was for.
So let's say, though, that it was just photos. The government can't get into the phone because of the passcode. What in the real world happens then in terms of your view is that the government has to provide access to the accused of material because, in your view, the government has possession, custody, and control. What actually would happen in that CID evidence room?
Right. Your Honor, the defense would have the non-discretionary right to inspect and copy it, which they could do without making any changes, very easily being
So would they walk out of the evidence room and go home and do the copies and come back and say, oh, here's your phone back? So CID would let this incriminating evidence just walk out the door?
Well, Your Honor, I think it could be done at CID, which I believe the defense conceded that it could be done, you know, physically there.
So what about a situation where the accused then says, oh, thank you for granting me access, boom, 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 poof. All that evidence is gone because, in fact, the accused wasn't accessing the evidence. It was the accused was getting rid of the evidence.
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be relatively easy, and I think this was discussed at trial, for controls to be placed on the access and copy, and that wouldn't make any changes.
So if it were a situation where a forensic expert on behalf of the government said, okay, give me your passcode, we'll do this together. You stand there, give me your passcode. Now we're into the photos. We've got them. You've got them. That's permissible in your view?
Well, Your Honor, I think the better course would be to say the defense has the non-discretionary right to inspect and copy, and then once they do that, they need to comply with their reciprocal discovery obligations.
So, but it sounds like you're saying it goes without any safeguards to an accused. I thought you were saying before that there would be the ability of the government to ensure that the evidence would not be destroyed or tampered with.
Right, Your Honor, I don't think the original phone or the data on the phone would be it would be relatively easy not to make any changes to that. And then the defense would get a mirror copy. And then the defense would still have their 701 Bravo obligations and any other reciprocal discovery obligations.
But isn't that exactly the deal that the appellant was offered that he declined?
Your Honor, I don't see anything in the military judge's ruling that would have limited government access to the scope of the authorization. And defense counsel repeatedly said, we will comply with our reciprocal discovery obligations. But the judge said the government must get equal and simultaneous access. And the government
— And what's wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor, because that goes beyond the scope of the original search authorization. Even if there was no password on the phone to begin with, the government would not have had full access on page 39 of the JA. Trial counsel says, our interpretation is if the defense opens the phone, they owe us the entire contents of the phone, which the government never would have been entitled to.
Counsel, can I ask about that? Now, I don't know what the government's going to argue, but in their opening brief, or in their answer brief, they seem to say that our search would be limited to the search authorization, and you say in your reply that there's nothing in either the written order or the comments that were made by the military judge on the rehearing. In fact, they seem to be the exact opposite. You have complete access to the whole phone. What if the government comes up and says, well, it was still implied that since we had this search authorization, even if the military judge didn't say it, it would still be implied that we couldn't go beyond our search authorization when we had access to all the data? I mean, we'd have access to all the data, but we couldn't go beyond our search authorization and looking at it. Could this be implied?
Your Honor, I would invite the government to point to anything in the military judge's ruling that would have put any such stipulation or limitation on government access. I just don't see it. To say it's implied, I mean, the judge seems to say the opposite, seems to say full and simultaneous access or equal and simultaneous access. And it's that equal access, which is the 701 echo that the judge keeps repeating, But equal access doesn't mean that the government gets everything the defense has.
And your position is essentially that if the military judge had said, if you open up the phone, the government could search what they're allowed to search for under the search authorization, this would be a different case. Not that you have to concede anything, because it's not your case here, but that would be a very different case.
It would be, right. And again, I would not concede that would be proper. I think it would still be largely maybe an issue of first impression, but that would be very different. I think the military judge's ruling elevates 701 Echo above the very specific provisions of Alpha and Bravo. The military judge even goes so far as to say that the status quo is acceptable because as things stand, both sides have equal access, which is to say no access. That's on JA at 39. But equal access or equal lack of access can't substitute for compliance with the specific provisions of 701 Alpha and Bravo. And then at JA at 41, I think there's another flaw in the military judge's analysis. The military judge says, the phone data may be evidence of a crime and therefore may be tantamount to contraband that cannot be turned over to or should not be turned over to the accused. Well, evidence of a crime is not contraband. Discovery and 701, of course, contemplate and mandate that evidence of crimes is turned over to the accused. The contraband is a different matter altogether. I mean, this is a drug case. Maybe the drugs themselves would be contraband, but the phone data is not contraband. Now, there's simply no basis in the rules for the military judges. The military judge's stipulation that appellant could only exercise his rights if he gave the government full access to all his highly personal data. The Supreme Court said in Riley,
Mr. Hockenberry, it's still not clear to me how the controls you talk about, how this would have worked. Could you kind of lay this out for me a little more from your standpoint, how this could have been accomplished in the way that you say your client's rights would have been protected?
Your Honor, I believe the DFEs and the defense had a digital forensic expert. Presumably the government did too, or maybe a CID.
Right. Well, let's say they did. That both sides had their forensic experts. And so what would you have proposed, and what is the problem with what the military judge proposed? As far as the defense, what would happen? The government would turn the phone over to the defense team, and they would, even if they're doing it in CID, they get to do it by themselves in there, and then what?
Well, Your Honor, I don't see any reason they'd have to do it by themselves. I think mechanically they would just plug in and make a full copy. So it's not like they're scrolling through the phone looking at messages or, I mean, if a CID agent...
Now, is that what was proposed, simply plugging in and making a full copy?
I think that was the defense request. It was access and copying, which could be done without any changes and with appropriate safeguards to ensure there was no changes. There'd be no... going through the phone manually. It would just be a copy, and then defense would have a copy.
Are you aware of any other jurisdictions that where criminal investigations are conducted like that? Just off the top of your head, I'm not asking if you've done a survey or anything. But.
Right. I think 701 Alpha and Alpha 2 Alpha 4 and Alpha 2 Alpha 1 are very clear that the defense gets to copy and access.
So what you're saying basically is it doesn't matter if there are any other jurisdictions that don't, it doesn't matter if no one else does it. 701 applies here and it is unique to the military justice system. Is that a fair assessment of
your
position?
I think it is, and discovery in the military justice system is broader. I'm sure there are similar rules in other jurisdictions.
Issue of the broadness of the rules of discovery, doesn't that mean that it's decisions by a military judge are viewed for an abuse of discretion and that they should have wide discretion in regulating discovery?
Your Honor, I think abuse of discretion is the standard, although I would say a lot of these questions are sort of questions of textual interpretation that would have a de novo standard. But as a whole, is abuse of discretion. In terms of the judge's authority to regulate discovery under 701 Gulf, I would argue that's more administrative. It doesn't give the ability to expand or contract the specific obligations.
So I just want to be clear. It's your position, then, that in the course of filing a 701 motion and the everything that happens as a result, an accused would have to provide the passcode to the forensic examiner on behalf of the government. The government then makes a copy and provides it to the accused.
Your Honor, that could be done that way, or I think the discussion at trial was that the passcode would be provided to the defense expert. Either way would work. I mean,
what if an accused just says, I'm not giving anybody the passcode? Does a 701 motion then fail or rule not apply?
Right, Your Honor. I think that in that case, I mean, essentially the accused would be blocking his own access to the data. I don't know on a technical level whether they can make a mirror copy without the password, but then would need the password to access it. But my impression is you would need the password to make the copy.
Further question?
I have one question. You were about to reference the Supreme Court's decision in Riley, and I'm sort of curious what it was in Riley that you think is beneficial to your case, because one of the major points from Riley I recall is that the Supreme Court in Riley undermined this assumption that cell phones should be treated as containers and that we should treat the cell phone, the physical cell phone itself, as distinct from the data within the cell phone. But maybe there's another aspect of Riley that you wanted to bring to our attention.
Your Honor, I was just referring to the language that cell phones are highly personal and government intrusion into cell phones implicates privacy concerns that go even beyond government intrusion into other forms of personal effects or papers.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hockenberry. Captain Duff.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Dominique Dove, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Richard Garrity, represent the United States. Your Honor, before I begin with my roadmap, I would like to answer your question about the safe and the combination lock. You spoke about physical property. So this safe is in the custody of CID, and they're unable to access the case. Appellant makes a specific showing saying that there's some type of exculpatory evidence within that safe box. The military judge then allows him to go in and access the safe. He goes in and pulls out the exculpatory evidence that he needs. At that point in time, the appellant would not then be able to close the safe and relock it because under RCM 701E, he is unreasonably impeding with governmental access to the evidence because the government, as in this case, had a legitimate and valid search and seizure authorization. There is no case law or any other precedent that would allow the appellant to come in, rummage through the safe box, close it, and then relock it.
Counsel, would the government be limited to searching what was in the search authorization, or could they have access to everything?
Your Honor, they would be limited to what was in the search authorization. And it is, in this case, the military judge, according to RCM 701G, made a specific criteria of time, place, and manner in which the appellant would be able to access the phone and then allow the appellant to go in. His authorization didn't say that they would have full access, as my colleague is trying to say. The military judge on JA 253 stated equal and simultaneous access, and that is according to RCM 701E, because the government then had a valid search and seizure authorization.
But could it look at things that were not covered on the search authorization? I mean, I think appellant's position was that this would be a different case if the military judge says, once you open up the phone, the government can search it pursuant to its search authorization, but they can't look at everything. But what the military judge said here was that the government could look at everything, and that's what the error was.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. The military judge did not state specifically that the government would be allowed to look at everything. The military judge said equal and simultaneous access. Let's say in this case, CID was able to unlock the code, the phone by breaking the passcode. At that time, they would have opened the phone and extracted all of the evidence and then found the evidence that was responsive to the search and seizure authorization. That is the exact same thing that the military judge was allowing when he made the criteria for the evidence.
So, counsel, is it the government's position then that the appellant would have also been limited by the parameters of the search warrant?
No, Your Honor. The appellant could go in and extract the full data. The appellant's DFE could go in and extract the full data, and then at that time, the government would have extracted the data that was responsive to the search authorization.
Okay, but then that wouldn't be equal and simultaneous. I mean, one is whole and one's a portion of it.
Your Honor, the equal access relates to being able to access the data on the phone, not the actual contents and information of the data. Just that once the appellant had the access to the phone, they must then allow the government to access the phone pursuant to the valid search and seizure authorization.
And then would it be the government's position that if, in fact, the appellant had copied all the data on the phone, that then the government could have a right to all that data based upon reciprocal discovery?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Please finish the answer.
The government would have only been allowed to access and copy the information that they were allowed pursuant to the valid search authorization. If at any point in time the appellant decided to use some of the information for the court-martial, then at that time the appellant would have been required to give that over to the government.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that answer. I think you saw my face like. So, okay.
And so what I was going to ask is, the accused at trial was presented with a deal. You don't have to open up the phone, but if you do open up the phone, the government gets equal access. And you're saying, well, that didn't really mean they could just do anything with the data. They were still limited by their search authorization. But my question is, what can you point to in the record that shows that the accused knew or had reason to understand that that was the deal being proposed? Because ultimately, the accused didn't accept that deal. And from just reading the judge's comments, particularly after the motion for reconsideration, it kind of sounded like the military judge says, if you open up that phone, the government can look at anything in that phone, and didn't mention the search authorization.
Your Honor, there's nothing on the record that reflects that the military judge said, once you open up this phone, then the government would be able to fully access and rummage through the phone. The military judge said, once your DFE access the phone, then the government DFE would be able to access the phone. Additionally, the military judge is presumed to know the law absent any evidence to the contrary. So the military judge would have made a ruling consistent with the valid search and seizure authorization. And here we do not have any claims of ineffective counsel, so this court could glean that the counsel informed appellant of his rights in regards to the evidence.
So I'd like to go back to the foundational question I posed to Mr. Hockenberry when he first got up. From the government's perspective, when the government is in possession of an accused phone but does not have the passcode, is the government in the possession, custody, and control of the data on that cell phone?
No, Your Honor. And for purposes of RCM 701 Alpha 1 Alpha, the government has a specific duty to disclose over information that might assist in appellant's trial. However, they have to have access to that information. So in this case, appellant's request, according to the Army Corps, which is correct, was twofold. First was to access the phone. The second was to access the data within the phone. And since the government did not have access to the data within the phone, the government did not have knowledge of what was in the phone. The appellant had a very low burden when he did his motion to compel, which was a preponderance of the evidence, to tell the military judge that there was exculpatory evidence on the phone and how he may use it on in the court-martial. He didn't have to give over everything that he planned on doing with his court-martial. However, he would have just had to say one or two sentences as why this was relevant and why he needed access to the phone.
But the counsel, to do so. You know, in 701, 2A, Romanet I, he could have access to it if the item was relevant to defense preparation. But under Romanet 4, the defense has access if the item was obtained from or belongs to the accused. I mean, I don't think you have to make any showing if the government, if you want to see something that belongs to you. I don't think there's any burden other than to show that it does belong to you and was taken for you.
That is correct, Your Honor. But the difference in this case is that the government had already seized the phone. And so the phone was already in the custody, possession, and control of the government. Had appellant had that phone and the government did not have it, then he would have full access to anything that he was legally entitled to. However, since the government seized the phone, now the appellant had his burden in the motion to compel to tell the government specifically what was needed, and then the government would have given him access to that. However, appellant failed to meet that burden.
Counsel, I think if we decide this case, we're going to have to define control and custody. Does it have to be complete control? I mean, the government had the right to, had the power to exclude the accused from seeing the data. Is that control?
Your Honor, in U.S. v. Strong, this court defined possession according to Black's Law Dictionary, and that was three parts. One was the taking or holding of the object, two was dominion and control of the object, and three was to the exclusivity of all others. Here, for purposes of RCM 701A2A21, it's regarding the dominion aspect of it. You cannot have dominion and control, dominion over property or data, if you don't have access of it for purposes of RCM 701, because the government's obligation was to turn over that information. If they don't have access and knowledge, according to U.S. v. Stellato, then the government is unable to give over that information for purposes of their discovery obligations.
Counsel, a little different question. So at trial, the trial counsel explicitly stated that the government, quote, had custody of the information on the phone, and also said that the evidence, meaning here the cell phone data, not just the cell phone, was within, quote, the control of the government. Is the government now on appeal stuck with those observation statements, concessions that are made by the trial counsel at the court-martial?
Your Honor, the answer to your question is twofold. First, no, we are not stuck with what the government said, because it doesn't really matter what the government said. It mattered what the military judge ruled and what he described in his ruling in order to determine whether there was an abuse of discretion. Second, in regards to the concessions, if you look at the JA on 36 and 37, it's two pages of the government saying the phone is in possession, custody, and control. The phone is in possession, custody, and control. When they made that statement, it was one sentence out of two pages of their argument. So you can glean that it might have just been a slip of the tongue, because data right now and the data, comparing data with a phone is a very new topic that this court is looking at. So the argument is that the two pages that the government was talking about, that you're talking about, Your Honor, the government was actually talking about the possession of the phone and not the information that was on the phone. I want to go to the military judge's ruling. According to RCM 701G, the military judge may dictate the time, place, and manner in which to disclose discovery evidence. Here, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in allowing the appellant to go to CID for multiple reasons. One, the legitimate governmental interest of destroying the evidence if they handed over the phone. And when looking at abuse of discretion, it is a very high standard. It is more than just a mere difference of opinion. The military judge made a reasonable and just decision to allow the appellant to come into CID and extract the data that he wanted. The appellant chose not to. Then under RCM 701E, the military judge spoke about equal and simultaneous access. When accessing the phone, the appellant was given the option to access the phone to extract the information that he needed, and then would have then allowed the government to extract the information pursuant to the valid search and seizure authorization. He could not then lock the phone and prevent the government from getting into his phone because the government did have a valid search and seizure authorization and they did have seizure and possession of the phone. If this court does find that the military judge abused his discretion, this court should still affirm the findings and sentence because the appellant was not prejudiced. Here, because it was a discovery request, this court would look at a standard of harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
But we don't have any idea what's on the phone, right? I mean, if the appellant is correct that he should have had access to the phone, we have no idea what's on the phone. How could we hold that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? What if there's GPS data that says he was three states away when the alleged acts occurred?
That is correct, Your Honor. There is no evidence as to what is on the phone because the appellant failed to reach their burden in stating what exculpatory evidence they needed and that it was relevant to their case. The only person who knew what was on the phone was the appellant. And in the record, the appellant conceded multiple times that there was inculpatory evidence on that phone. So this court can glean that once given the option of accessing the phone and given the time to think about it, that the appellant weighed those exculpatory versus inculpatory evidence on the phone and decided not to use it in his case, which would go to support that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Additionally,
Can you go through that point again? You're suggesting that if the exculpatory evidence outweighed the inculpatory evidence, he would have agreed to the deal, but he didn't agree to the deal, and so therefore we can conclude that it was harmless. Is that the logic?
You can conclude, Your Honor, that there was inculpatory evidence on the phone that may have supported other criminal activities or supported these specifications. However, the only person who knew what was on the phone was the appellant, and the appellant specifically stated multiple times in the record that there was inculpatory evidence on the phone. Additionally, the circumstantial evidence in appellant's guilt was overwhelming. This court should not be concerned with the specifications 8 and 9 under charge 2 because they were confirmed by two separate urinalyses that goes to the dates on those specifications. So we're just looking at the other specifications of wrongful use of cocaine and the fraternization charge. With that, you had three different witnesses testify to appellant's drug use, to sending appellant money to buy drugs, and partying with the appellant. Additionally, it was supported by Cash App transactions that showed the dates of these instances. And when you look at previous court cases like U.S. v. Roberts and U.S. v. Coleman, this court has stated that although there was an abuse of discretion, there still was the evidence was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. When looking at U.S. v. Roberts, this court said the circumstantial evidence was overwhelming. That's the same as in this case. You look at U.S. v. Coleman, there was actual Brady violation, and this court still said that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, this is just a hypothetical, maybe exculpatory evidence. However, the appellant never stated what was actually needed, and therefore was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm seeing there are...
I had one question just to clear up something. I may have just gotten lost in your discussion with Judge Maggs, but so rather than the argument about between exculpatory and inculpatory evidence or the possibility thereof on the phone doesn't go to the issue of, therefore, prejudice as much as it goes to the issue of why the accused may have decided not to take the take this arrangement, to accept this arrangement. Is that
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Further questions? Seeing none, did you want to briefly conclude?
Thank you, Your Honor. For the reasons mentioned, this Court should affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Dove. Mr. Hockenberry.
Your Honors, regarding the idea that maybe the military judge's order would indeed have limited the government to the scope of the search authorization, that certainly wasn't the government's position at trial. And trial counsel at JA at 39 says, our position is that if appellant opens the phone or the accused at that time opens the phone, it will owe the government the entire contents of the phone. And that seems to be the position the judge adopted with his language. To the extent that the government was limited, I suppose, to Your Honor's question, with the judge saying equal access, does that mean appellant was also limited? I mean, that would not really make sense. Or if it was some sort of implied limitation, as was pointed out, how would appellant have known about it when he was had to make the choice about whether or not to give the government access?
Counsel, is this distinction on the government side just sort of semantic? Because if they had cracked they'd been able to break into the phone, they would have had access to the entire contents of the phone, but they would only be allowed to use things that fell within the search warrant, even though they would have access to everything. Does it really make any difference? Is the military just saying, like, well, once you're in the phone, you have access to everything, but of course you can only use what you have a search warrant for? And then maybe you'll find some stuff and you'll get a new search warrant that's even broader or more specific. But if they had broken into the phone, wouldn't the situation be exactly the same? They'd have access to the whole phone, but they would only have a legal right to use as evidence in the court-martial that data and information that was covered by their search authorization?
Yeah, Your Honor, I think if there was no passcode or if the government had cracked the passcode, I still don't think they would have access to all the data because they would have to limit their access to the scope of the authorization,
well,
which was
quite
narrow.
They could clone the whole phone. Technically speaking, they would have access to the whole phone.
Right.
The expert would be able to clone all of the contents of the phone. They would have access to it. Now, the search authorization would limit what they could legally use at trial. But is there any real difference there? I guess it seems like this is what they always have. Once they break into a phone, they always have access to the entire phone, but they're limited by what their search authorization allows.
Right. Your Honor, I suppose they would have the ability to access it, but they wouldn't be allowed to access it. And they couldn't.
Right. So why would the situation here be any different? They have a search authorization. You haven't challenged the search authorization. At trial, they would have been limited by the search authorization. If they had gone beyond the search authorization, I assume defense would have objected. How is this any different than every situation where you break into a phone?
Right. I think the government at trial is pretty clearly saying if the defense opens it, we get everything. And that, of course, is trial counsel saying that. But the judge seems to adopt that position. And when the judge says the government will have equal access to appellant, and that would suggest that there was not that limitation on it.
Mr. Hockenberry, what was the accused's basic concern? Was he more concerned with the evidence that might be revealed through the scope of the search warrant, or was he concerned or more concerned about the fact that, as Judge Hardy has put it, the government would have access, even if they didn't go look at it, to the rest of the phone?
Right, right. Your Honor, I don't know that that's on the record, as I guess you wouldn't expect it to be.
But no,
I think both would be concerning, but certainly the very broad language the military judge uses would be a valid source of concern with all the personal data that is on one's phone.
Counsel,
go ahead.
Can I ask you a question that's a little unrelated? in the military justice system, is there any way that a military judge can order an accused simply to provide a passcode? We'll only search the phone according to the search authorizations, but you have to provide the passcode. Is there any way to do that?
Your Honor, I don't believe there is. I think Mitchell was about that, I believe. But I don't think that would be permitted. And then with regard to, I guess, the first issue, I mean, government counsel talks about the government didn't have knowledge and access, but the triggering factors in 701 are not knowledge or access. They're possession, custody, or control, disjunctively. And frankly, I still don't think we had an argument from the government about how the government did not have custody of both the phone and its contents. And, of course, there was trial counsel's concession on that point as well. So pending further questions, appellant requests this court answer the three granted issues in the affirmative and set aside some or all of the convictions.
Chief, I have one.
Please, Judge Johnson.
Thank you. I was going to circle back when Judge Maggs and I spoke at the same time. What should we make of the argument the government makes that the appellant did not meet his burden, the specificity burden, to show the relevance of the potentially exculpatory evidence on the phone?
Your Honor, I think the Army Court went that direction, too, which was not really the direction the military judge went, but said that the appellant at trial did not talk enough about what would be relevant on the phone. But that's a very low bar, and it was conceded by the trial counsel on JA at 48 that there was reason to believe there may be exculpatory evidence. So I think that alone would meet A2, A1. And then, as I think was pointed out during questioning of the government, even that was unnecessary because this was seized from, obtained from, or belonging to the accused. So I think A2, A4, appellant would get it anyway. So once 701 is triggered, I don't think there's any debate that appellant was entitled to the 701 alpha access. And there was no need to proffer more about what was on the phone.
Okay. May I ask one last question?
Absolutely.
In your very last statement, you said set aside some or all of the, or all or some of the specifications. Can you comment on specs 8 and 9, which I think the government said those were proved by your analysis results and whatever's on the phone, it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, I could see a difference between those specifications and 5 through 7, although in terms of the strength of the evidence, I don't think just the fact that they're your analysis specifications based on your analysis make them sort of so strong that prejudice could not be had. Really, your analysis-based prosecutions are arguably some of the weakest, as this Court was recently discussing in the Downham oral argument, that there's case law from this Court that they need to be scrutinized very carefully and may not even pass constitutional muster in the civilian world. So I do think that those specifications are sort of not really like above scrutiny. I could see that, you know, just the probability of, you know, the phone undermining those might be less than 5 through 7. So there may be a difference there in the prejudice analysis. But it's a high burden for the government, the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt burden, and it's hard to analyze, as Your Honor pointed out, because we don't know what was on the phone.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hockenberry. The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides, and the Court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. The Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.